calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. 1,649 days since 9/11. Of course, the total length of World War II from Pearl Harbor to VE Day, 1,245 days. The count continues. George Bush saying future presidents are going to decide how this thing gets wrapped up, not him. Go figure. Whether or not there's going to be troops in Iraq, remarkable. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln. You can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Coming up on the program, by the way, today, Judy Wicks, the owner and founder of Philadelphia's 23-year-old White Dog Cafe, is going to be talking about what local living economies are, how they work, that and your calls. But right now, Myron Abell is with us. Myron is the Director of Energy and Global Warming Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Myron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Hey, Myron, is our large corporate monopoly responsible for the largest mass extinction since the dinosaur? You have Richard Leakey out there. He's published this book called The Sixth Extinction, saying that we now have species going extinct at a rate that has not been seen since the death of the dinosaurs. And It seems like there are folks on your side who are saying, well, you know, no big deal. In fact, we don't even need the Endangered Species Act.
Well, I think that the claim that there's some kind of mass extinction going on is very speculative, and I think there's almost no evidence for it. One problem, of course, is, and this is true of both sides of this argument, and is that we have no idea how many species there are. The number that has been cataloged is just a small fraction of the total that they're believed to be. So when you claim that a lot of species are going extinct, the people who are doing that are not pointing at species we know about that are already cataloged. They're making some kind of estimate based on a model, which is based on, I think, generally this island claim. Various people, including E.O. Wilson, the other guy, I forget his name, studied some islands, and they showed if you take away X percentage of the habitat, you will lose X percentage of the species. But islands aren't like continents.
Well, here's what the United Nations Environment Program had to say about this as a consequence of their Global Environment Outlook GEO3 mm-hmm. program. This is a seven-year study. They looked at a total of 11,046 known species of plants and animals that are known to face a high risk of extinction, including 1,130 mammal species, 24% of all mammals at high risk for extinction, and 1,183 species of birds, 12% of the total, that are at high risk of extinction. They said that I'm quoting from the study, human activities from habitat destruction to the introduction of alien species from one area of the world to another are listed as major causes of this dramatic loss in biodiversity. And then they went on to identify 5,611 species of plants that they know to be on the verge of extinction. But they point out that since only 4% of the known plant species in the world have been evaluated, as you point out, their take on it is very different. They say, you know, if we've got 5,600 that we know are on the edge of extinction, and we only know about 4% of the plants, that there's probably massive numbers of plant species that are on the edge of or going extinct right now. And this is the central thesis of Richard Leakey's book, mm-hmm. and that this is a very real problem.
Well, again, the claim is based on extrapolations when we're working in a world where we only know a fraction of the species that exist. As some people on our side have written articles which I think make a point, although it's a limited point, and that is, show me some species that are going extinct right now, not that are in danger of or you think are going to go extinct in the near future. Show me what's happened over the last 100 years. And it's very difficult for the proponents of these.
Well, the UN catalog 816 specific species that have gone extinct.
Right, right.
That's a lot of species. I mean, we had the Pacific yew tree.
Well, no,
it was nearly extinct, and we discovered that it had the cure for breast cancer, Taxol, in it.
But Tom, if you have X million species, and I don't know whether it's 10 million or 20 million species,
right.
You're going to have some going extinct all the time. The claim is that the numbers that have been identified since historic time that have gone extinct, that this is somehow different than the background rate of extinction? I sort of doubt it.
Well, E.O. Wilson's hypothesis, if I recall correctly, is that it's been a few years since I read this, but that it's in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight,
mm-hmm.
is that the background rate of extinction is around 4 species per year, and the mutation rate, the generation of new species, is around 4 per year, and so it's net neutral. And we're experiencing now, per day. And we're experiencing right now a loss of about 100 species a day. Now, this includes bacteria, insects. I mean, this is huge.
I'd like you to point out one of these. You know, again, it's working in a very large field of ignorance where we don't even know what these species are.
So, you know, I know that it's, you know, one of the strategies of folks who want to try to avoid any kind of government regulation to say, you know, we don't know all the details on this, so let's just back off on government regulation. And I assume, Myron Ebell, CEI.org, that that's where you're going with this. But really, if we really don't know all the details, shouldn't we take the most cautious route rather than the least cautious route?
Well, no, where I'm going with this is that, and you mentioned the Endangered Species Act earlier, the Endangered Species Act is actually an impediment to saving habitat for endangered species. It's doing much more damage than if we didn't have it at all. And
how is inhibiting development harming species?
Well, it's because most of the species that are felt to be endangered in this country depend largely on private land for their habitat.
That's simply because most of the land in the United States is in private hands.
Yeah, 70% of it is in private hands. But even still, the federal lands are so mismanaged that even in areas of the West where there are endangered species on federal land, they're probably, in many cases, more dependent on private land than they are in federal land.
Well, and in part, that's because a lot of the federal lands have been sold off leased out to mining interests, to drilling interests, and are being managed basically for the forest industry.
Well, I'd like you to find a single species that's gone extinct as a result of mining or drilling. Forestry, of course, now...
Well, that's like saying, can you find one person who has cancer as a result of the tobacco industry? Cancer doesn't pop up with a little sign saying, hi, I was caused by that cigarette he had on Thursday, the 22nd of June, 1946.
No, that's not the right analogy. That's not the right analogy. But look, if you look at the forest situation now, because we stopped cutting trees, basically, on our national forests, what we're going to have is massive catastrophic forest fires, which are going to extinct species.
But we haven't stopped cutting trees. I mean, we're cutting trees all over the country, of course.
You look at the numbers, it's gone down from over 10 billion board feet a year, which is still below the replacement rate. It's down below 3 billion board feet a year. So, and in fact, I think it's actually around 1 billion board feet a year. So we have basically stopped timber production on federal land, and that is going to lead to extinction. But to go back to private property,
how is that going to lead to extinction
catastrophic fires? A lot of species that are in one little geographic area cannot withstand a catastrophic fire that actually just chars everything.
And yet that species was the consequence of millions and millions of years of evolution in that place without any humans messing with it, without humans, you know, cutting down trees or replanting them or anything else. And in fact, you know, when we cut them, we tend to replant them in monoculture. Could it be that the problem isn't so much, hey, we've got to look out for fire, as 100 years ago we were doing lousy forest management by creating monoculture forests?
No. In fact, since the last ice age, and when the for instance, the so-called ancient forests returned to the Pacific Northwest, take one example, and that's not – it's the big Douglas fir forest didn't return 12,000 years ago when the ice age started. There were many generations of types of vegetation leading up to Douglas fir. So we haven't had those big Douglas fir forests for more than a few thousand
right.
years.
We have and only about Indians, a half a minute left, Myron.
Yeah, and the Indians have been managing those forests using fire up until the white men took them over. And so, no, these have not been, pure. They haven't been wilderness. They have been managed by people. And so now that we're no longer managing them, we're going to get catastrophic fire. But to go back to private property, people have to have an incentive. If your land is going to be stolen by regulation, your incentive is to clear the habitat so you do not have an endangered species on it. And that's what's going on in many places in this country.
And therefore, you think we should just do away with the Endangered Species
Act? No, I think we should reform it so that it protects property rights first, because we understand that the right incentives are what will make private property owners create
property habitat. Rights first, species rights second.
You know, property rights is essential for protecting the habitat
for species rights. Okay, Myra Nobel, CEI, Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Why does the sun go on shining? Why does the sea rush to shore? Don't they know it's the end of the world? 'Cause you don't love me anymore.
Oh, no! Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A total of 11,046 species of plants and animals are now known to face a high risk of extinction. I'm telling you, this the conservatives got to them here in Oregon before I got here. I've been here for, it'll be a year next month. And about a year and a half ago, the cons came along and they ran these ads in the election, the November election. It was 2 years ago in November this year. In which they said, you know, we've got to pass this thing called Measure 37, and I'm telling you, this is coming to a state near you. Sponsored by folks who say, well, we've got to have land use that, you know, if we don't have intelligent land use with higher priority for property owners than endangered species, then the endangered species are not going to be protected. And that was, you know, that was a variation on this thing. The thing here was, well, if your property, your private property, this is all about private property, right? If your private property is reduced in value or has not increased in value as much as it could have because of regulations, for example, let's say that you own some property that has a swamp on it. Well, you can't drain the swamp. Sorry, the Wetlands Protection Act prevents you from doing that. Or you've got an endangered species on it, and so you can't log it. Then the state has to, Grandma wants to sell her house. And the way they sold this thing, by the way, was literally with Grandma wanting to sell her house. And there had been a change. There's some strange part of some place in Portland or something like that, as a result of change in zoning or rules, Grandma's house wasn't worth as much. And so, you know, it was, hey, Granny, you got to help me out here, people. I'm losing my inheritance. And so the state, this was passed by a ballot initiative, not by the legislators. It was passed by the people with a fairly good majority that said that the state must either do one of two things. It must either reimburse you for the reduced value of your land as a consequence of those rules. In other words, if they discover an endangered species, say you're a contractor and you buy 100 acres and you're going to build houses on it, and you plan to make $1 million, you bought it for $100,000, you're going to be able to sell it for $1,100,000. So you got $1 million in play here, in profit coming along on your $100,000 investment, once you build the houses. And then they discover that it's got the golden toad on it or something. This is one of the species that went extinct recently. The last known golden toad, so you can't develop it. Then the state either has to reimburse you the loss that you had. In other words, the state writes you a check for $1 million and says, you know, sorry, your land's not worth as much as it could be here. We'll make it up to you. Or the rule gets thrown out. And interestingly, when the conservatives put this thing into play, it's called Measure 37 in Oregon, there was no funding mechanism. But the average voter didn't realize that. So the average voter's sitting around going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Poor granny, you know, her house isn't worth as much because they just rezoned the area around her. And so, you know, yeah, the state should make up for that. After all, they changed the rules. She didn't have anything to do with it. She didn't have any say in it. It's only fair. But there's no funny mechanism. So granny's not making any more money on it. She can now sell her house, however, for a toxic incinerator, you know, for one to be sited there, or a landfill or something, which would have been illegal before. Because if the state can't reimburse her, then there's no rules. And all over the state of Oregon now, we've got communities, particularly agricultural communities, hysterical. They're freaking out. Out in wine country, just 50, 60 miles, north of here? No, south of here. You've got all these, vineyards and things, and now they used to have protections that you couldn't put 500 homes on the next farm down. Or you couldn't put, a toxic waste site there. You couldn't put a landfill there because, it would ruin your ability to grow the grapes for the wine. And the local communities had done their zoning, and they said, this is the character that we want to have in our community. And now this just passed muster in the state Supreme Court. They said, hey, the voters voted for this. They might have been misinformed. They might have been lied to by the developers because it was the developers who were hustling this thing with granny on the TV commercials. But, they passed it. And since the state doesn't have the ability to reimburse people, then all the rules are gone. And we're just seeing literally hundreds of laws, hundreds of rules, hundreds of regulations across the state vanish in a blink of an eye. And there's a national assault on this, and that's this is the whole, and the whole conservative shtick is going to be, this is all about land use, this is all about property rights. Let's go back to John Locke, life, liberty, and private property is what John Locke wrote about in his second treatise on government back in 1716, I think it was. He was actually alive and writing in the late 1600s. 1724 was when the second treatise on government was published, as I recall. And Jefferson looked at that, and he said, yeah, life, liberty, and private property? No. Well, let's change that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because we're about living together in a community, not just, a selfish, libertarian, bizarre little world where it's you and your property and your shotgun, and that's it. But that's the direction the cons want to take us, my friends. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's time to look inside and see. Just what we have become.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. It'll get you in there, and you can say hello to some of the finest minds in the whole entire Internet. Matt in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on the line. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Matt?
Well, the guy that you had from the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Right.
And right off the bat, his argument was fallacious. Starts with a classic straw man. What was I going to say? that we need to know the total number of species on the planet in order to figure out the rate of extinction.
Right.
That's garbage. We don't.
Right.
So, anyways, I just want to make that comment real quick.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
There we go.
I agree with you, Matt, and I think that was the point that I was making. I mean, obviously, we don't know all of the species, but why not at least err on the side of safety? I mean, this is
crazy. It's more than that. I mean, he's trying to take the science and turn it into something else that it gets those that maybe don't have an inkling on this stuff.
Sure.
That's just a problem, that humans always share, and we always share, but right off the bat, the guy was just messed up.
Thus, our quote for the day, you can fool some of the people some of the time, all of the time. You can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. From Abraham Lincoln. 1-866-440-8466. Jim in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, I'd like to echo the sentiments of the last caller, because this guy started off, he sounds like the Ann Coulter of the EPA.
Well, they are taking on. I mean, this UN report came out on Monday, right? This big report came out of this big conference that the UN has on biodiversity and the loss of species, and they pointed out that we're in the midst of, apparently in the midst of an extinction.
Right.
I mean, a major extinction. And said that it's human-caused, and so now Competitive Enterprise Institute, and I'm assuming other other conservative think tanks out there as well, will be mounting a full court press on, let's use this to do away with the Endangered Species Act, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, but at the same time, did they do any study, or are they just reacting? That's what
no.
It sounds like.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a think tank. They don't do studies. They pontificate.
Uh-huh. In any event, the last caller had it right. This guy's using bogus materials to back up an argument that's still born.
Yeah, okay. Jim, I don't disagree with you at all. Jim, thank you very much for the call. Bruce in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
Best thing you
By the way, if you love the show, Bruce, patronize our advertisers or at least let them know you're listening.
Okay.
Particularly the local ones. But,
okay.
not to put down the national ones, but particularly the local ones.
I fully intend to. And the best thing you do is have those guys from the Ayn Rand Institute and the CIA, Competitive Enterprise Institute on to actually dig their own graves. I mean, all I wanted to say was that the whole idea, that issue of public versus private management of land, it's not a pie-in-the-sky academic thing. I mean, I could take that guy on a drive, and you could, too. You live in Western Oregon. Take him on a drive around the Olympic Peninsula and show him how well Boise Cascade and Weyerhaeuser, quote-unquote, manage their land. Not that the National Forest Service does a particularly great job, but by comparison, it's just, it's clear-cut all the way to the horizon, and I guess that's what their definition of forest management.
And we also have to keep in mind that at the national level, that we have gone through a series of kind of intellectual evolutions, first of all. I mean, there was the National Forest Service for a long time did have a practice of stopping all fire, and it turns out, in retrospect, that wasn't a good idea, and they've changed their mind on that, in my understanding. And secondly, during the Reagan administration, when James Watt was Secretary of the Interior, and during the Bush administration, with Gail Norton as Secretary of the Interior, the Interior Department managing our federal lands has been run far more closely with an eye to what the timber industry or the mining industries want than with, what might be good for the ecosystems and the biosphere. Thus the tragedy at all.
Those guys, they're all about the ideology, and oh man, I just got so worked up listening to that guy. I was screaming in this work, screaming at the radio. That's all I wanted to say, man. You're awesome. Love your show, and just keep it up.
Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Morning, Tom. I'd like to comment, if I may, and then ask you one question.
Sure.
I submit strongly as you, and doing a wonderful job, Tom. Just a wonderful job.
Well, thank you. Gary, patronize our advertisers.
Oh, I have already.
This is listener-supported radio. It's free, but the way that our listeners support it is by patronizing our advertisers. Anyway, as you were saying.
I submit that I respect the presidency. I still respect it, and I will continue to respect it. However, there's a big but here. Across the board, George Bush's and Dick Cheney's philosophy and vision for America is wrong, and I think we're right. They're wrong, and we think we're right. That's what the argument here is.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to that, did you hear the latest sales pitch at the press conference?
I didn't hear the press conference this morning. I was on the air.
Well, okay. In my opinion, basically, I'm not going to be specific. You don't have the time. The latest sales pitch from George Bush and the presidency.
Right.
And basically speaking, the two themes were the economy, obviously, and the war.
Yeah, I do have one sound clip. Here's Bush about U.S. troops. This is just a 16-second clip here, Gary.
Will there come a day, and I'm not asking you when, I'm asking for a timetable, will there come a day when there will be no more American forces in Iraq?
That, of course, is an objective, and that'll be decided by future presidents and future governments of Iraq.
In other words, we're not going to pull out of Iraq while over the next 3 years while he's president.
I hope I'm wrong on this, but I'm going to make a statement. I believe George Bush, our president, is running out of gas philosophically.
Yeah, well,
I hear a lot of deep, you know, in all due respect to the president, I'm worried about him. I hear a lot of, everybody's got anxiety. We all do. I hear a lot, and he has a lot of pressure on his job.
Mm.
However, I hear a lot of anxiety in his voice, and I'm worried.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't disagree with you, and I'm concerned that that anxiety may translate into some sort of irrational action like, gee, let's have a war someplace, because that's what he knows how to do well. That he really is, you know, very good at that, at beating up on people. And,
right. My question is to you, in your opinion, obviously I have an opinion, you can hear it probably through my comment. Do you think that the president and would be gracious enough, if you will, to split the difference? Here's my thing. To split the difference, he believes so strongly on the war and what he's pursuing, right?
Yeah. Well, he says
he
does.
All right. Right or wrongly, he may still be right in a sense, but why can't he split the difference with us and be gracious enough about the economy? He wants us to continue the tax cuts? He's dead wrong.
Because his worldview, his father's worldview, his grandfather's worldview, the conservative worldview, is that all of that stuff that Franklin Roosevelt did, Social Security, unemployment insurance, it's all got to go. Child labor laws got to go. Minimum, maximum work weeks, 40-hour week, it's got to go.
No way.
Just the whole thing. No, I'm
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And that's what they're all—that's what they're all about, Gary. That's just absolutely what they're all about. I appreciate the call, though. Thank you very much, Mike, in Panama City Beach, Florida. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. What's up?
Quick note, if I might.
Hmm.
Have you seen the Penn and Teller thing on Showtime?
I have not.
Bull hockey.
No.
And they attack various preconceptions and so forth. Last week they did two programs. One was about the stupidity of the Endangered Species Act and how it's affecting real people. And the second half-hour show was on Frankenfoods.
Hmm.
And the problem of it is they keep on conflating different issues. And as their authoritative voice on the Endangered Species Act, they were using the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Oh, gee, what a surprise.
And, you know, they...
It's just like, you know, Bill Schneider, the guy that Wolf Blitzer has on all the time on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
He's a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute.
Right.
A senior fellow. I mean, the guy's a right-wing crank, and, you know, with a right-wing political organization, and he's their senior political analyst.
Right. And, you know... What they did here to tug at everyone's heartstrings, they said, see how this is affecting real people and damaging them, and they showed this poor woman who, I think she had multiple sclerosis or some horrible affliction that had her wheelchair bound, and her home was destroyed in the hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
She was trying to rebuild a home near her mother's place in Florida, but because of the Endangered Species Act, they wouldn't allow her to build.
Yeah.
Even though they pointed out that just down the block in the same area, in the same protected area, the state of Florida had given Walmart an exemption from the Endangered Species Act to build Walmart.
Right.
But they wouldn't allow her an exemption to build her house.
Right.
That has nothing to do with the Endangered Species Act. What that has to do is with Florida and allowing exemptions for Walmart, not for a single home.
Right. It's the corruption of the Jeb Bush administration is the bottom line there. Mike, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. I didn't realize that Penn and Teller were going off on this right-wing stuff. That's tragic. You know, John Stossel is enough. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it all started with O.J. running in his old white Bronco.
Where's O.J.?
Running from the law with a bloody glove. He hit the road. And here we are in the middle of a war with glamour, fighting to be free.
Well, he's a man's destruction.
There's a patriot act at home. It's modern than you and me.
Man's destruction.
But it's water on the bridge when the next thing you know there's a new spot to sex
tape. Weapons of mass destruction.
Or reality show, it's crossed the line. Jessica Simpson's made.
Man's destruction.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. It's amazing the stuff coming out of the right these days.
I'm not making this up.
No, they're not. They're really not. Our quote from the day from Abraham Lincoln, you can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time. And no, we will not be fooled. Sean in Boston, Massachusetts on the line. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
Hi, yeah. I was just on the Sam Cedars show, and I was discussing, and he cut me off, too, how the the Second World War was funded by one bank on both sides. The Warburg Bank, Max Warburg supported Hitler and Paul Warburg supported the Allies. You see, the whole game is, and when I spoke to somebody about it, they said, oh, that's business, huh? You know.
Yeah. And, Sean, I'm gonna cut you off, too, because we're not, it's off topic and you're listening to the wrong show. Lou in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Lou.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Let me get my phone out of the speaker. Hey, you know, I worked 4 months in the, you know, Mississippi coast and Louisiana area for Bell South. I'm a fiber splicer. And I got to tell you, Bush is making me rich, but I don't like making money this way because I can see hurricanes coming for the next decade that I'll be working on. And they make an argument because even the right, the sane ones at least, say, well, yes, we know there's something going on climate-wise, but this is cyclical. It always happens. It happens over hundreds and thousands of years, not decades.
Right. Yeah.
And
no,
right
these...
now the change is over, you know, unprecedentedly fast. And
yeah.
60 Minutes on Sunday had the one of the federal scientists, the only one of the few left that will question the administration, submitting, you know, statistics about the glacial melt and everything. And some lawyer pencils in over this guy's scientific data, changing it, going, well, that doesn't read right. I'm going to change it and, you know, say it's not, I don't believe what you're saying. And the guy's not a trained scientist. He's a lawyer.
Yeah, and what's so scary about this is Kevin Phillips has a new book out, and I believe today is the release date. It's shipping right away here. And in this new American Theocracy. And in this book, according to the review I read Sunday in the New York Times, Kevin Phillips makes the point that many people in the Bush administration, and apparently Bush himself, believe that if they can bring about a war in the Middle East and satisfy the final requirements of the 50-some-odd prophecies that Hal Lindsey back in the 70s decided were the hidden prophecies in the Bible or the overt prophecies in the Bible to bring back Jesus, then everything will be made new and, you know, it doesn't matter what's going on, or all the good people will go to heaven and, you know, those of us who don't, who aren't good people by the definitions of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, are going to be stuck with this planet Earth, and who cares about us, right?
Well, I'm a former Marine, and I can tell you, I didn't go to fight for the Christian Taliban, and that's what we got now.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt about it.
As hell. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Lou. Good to hear from you, and thanks for the call. Tony in San Diego, California. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. This is an interesting story for you. My wife and I are bleeding heart liberals, and we live in an area that's in desperate need of preschool. So my wife came up with this idea. I'm going to go buy some land and build a preschool in an area where children can actually have space to run. So she purchased 2.5 acres of land, so she's going to build a preschool on it. But the purpose is there's lots of space outside, and she can teach them about nature and that kind of stuff. The process of building the school, come across that, of course, we're in habitat areas that have certain kind of species that we need to protect.
Yeah, I was going to say, you bought 2.5 acres in San Diego for how much?
$410,000.
Yeah, that's
just outside of San Diego.
Yeah, that's pretty cheap. I mean, you know, outside of San Diego, that you must have known that that there were restrictions on that property if you got it for kind of price.
Yeah. Oh no, we totally knew.
Yeah.
But this is the part that's funny about this. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. The regulations are set up where we live in the city and the county, in that it doesn't matter what species are there. They don't care. All they care is that you pay a species mitigation fee. So if they find this PC, you just get, all right, that's going to cost you $10,000, and it goes into this fund. Go ahead and develop, wipe out the species if you want.
You're kidding.
All you got to do is just, no, seriously, you just pay a species mitigation fee.
I asked
what it was about, and they said you're supposedly buying a percentage of open space somewhere in Fallbrook, which I think is a bunch of BS. But the point of the whole story is you can totally get around it. Where I live, there's so much open space, and it gets developed all the time. And I just think, what's the purpose of any of this?
Yeah.
If you can just pay a fee and get around it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, she's not going to wipe out the species. She's going to build in one part because she's trying to protect the rest of her land, but so that she can actually have open space. But it's just hilarious that you can just get right around it by paying a fee.
Yeah. Well, and here in Oregon, all you have to do is say now that the voters, the taxpayers, passed this crazy Measure 37, here in Oregon, all you have to do is say to the state, by the way, please reimburse me for the losses, and the state doesn't have any money allocated for this. Zero. Not even $1. So the state has to say, oh, well, we'll just that law just doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah,
doesn't matter. You don't even have to pay
classic.
A species mitigation fee in Oregon.
Yeah, no, that is classic ballot initiative stuff right there.
Yeah, it's incredible, and they sold it with Granny. I mean, you know, it is these guys are so slick. They are so slick. It is just incredible. Tony, thanks a lot for the call.
Sure.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. This, you know, and on and on and on it goes. And what they are missing is the whole essence of the idea of a social contract, of the idea that we together collectively have decided that there are some things that are valuable for all of us. And these, Ayn Randys, the libertarians, the right-wing conservatives, their worldview is, no, it's mine. It's all about me. And there may be a reason for that. It actually tracks back to preschool. I'll tell you about that after the news at the top of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 57 minutes past the hour. You're in the Democracy Zone. And we'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 1,035 days left on Bush's term of office, assuming that he doesn't get impeached. Speaking of which...
Now, behind enemy lines...
Yes, let's look at what the GOP has. What's their strategy for dealing with this whole thing of the possibility of his being impeached? Yeah, they're coming. You know, because you've heard that Russ Feingold here saying, hey, the president broke the law. The FISA law says you can't wiretap people without a warrant. Bush ordered it. He broke the law. He should be held to account for that. And now we're learning that apparently he also broke into people's houses without a warrant, maybe yours or mine. Certainly there's a lawyer right here in Portland who claims that his house was broken into without a warrant by the Bush administration illegally. So the Republicans have decided that they're fighting back. Here's a new commercial from the GOP playing on radio stations all across the country.
September 11th changed our country, and it changed how America responds to terrorists. President Bush is working to keep American families safe, passing the Patriot Act, which has disrupted over 150 terrorist threats and cells.
Oh, really? We'd like to know a little bit more about those. Or are you just pulling a number out of your,
making sure the U.S. is monitoring terrorist communications.
Monitoring terror? No, I thought you were monitoring our communications, and that's the problem.
But some Democrats are working against these efforts to secure our country, opposing the Patriot Act and terrorist surveillance program.
Terrorist surveillance program? This is the new word for illegal wiretapping.
Their leader is Russ Feingold.
Yes, let's take out Russ Feingold. This is a full court press. These guys, this is an indication of what a danger Russ Feingold, a.k.a. the truth, represents to George W. Bush.
Now Feingold and other Democrats want to censure the president, publicly reprimanding President Bush for pursuing suspected members of Al-Qaeda.
No, publicly censuring him for breaking the law.
Some Democrats are even calling for President Bush's impeachment. Is this how Democrats plan to win the war on terror?
No, this is how we plan to hold accountable a president who's breaking the law. Gee, don't you get it?
Call Russ Feingold and ask him why he's more interested in censuring the president than protecting our freedom.
Well, maybe you should call Russ Feingold. His toll-free number, 888-355-3588. We can agree with the GOP on that, 1-888-355-3588. In fact, I even went to his website at russfeingold.org, I think it is, and gave him $25. I mean, you know, it's, get in touch with Russ Feingold.
Paid for by the Republican National Committee, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. www.gop.com. The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Now, you wonder, you know, a person who voices a spot like that, you know, is she just kind of politically ignorant? Is it just a gig, just a job? Or could it be that there's still a few people in America who actually believe this stuff? It's RussFeingold.org, by the way. Thank you. Are there still people in America who actually believe this stuff? Is it possible? Could be. By the way, I promised that I would share with you why conservatives think the way they do. Yes. Time for something, you know, one of those little you thought you knew, but you didn't know, right? This from the Toronto Star. Remember that whiny, insecure kid at nursery school, the one who always thought everyone was out to get him and was always running to the teacher with complaints? Chances are he grew up to be a conservative! At least he did if he was one of the 95 kids in the Berkeley area that social scientists have been tracking for the last 20 years. The confident, resilient, self-reliant kids mostly grew up to be liberals. This is a study, a 20-year longitudinal study just published in the Journal of Research into Personality. The results, they say, are worth a look. Started back in the 1960s, Jack Block and his wife and fellow professor Jean Block, now deceased, began tracking more than 100 nursery school kids as part of a general study on personality. The kids' personalities were rated at the time by teachers and assistants who had known them for months. No reason to think political bias skewed the ratings. The investigators were not looking for political orientation back then, and even if they had been, it's unlikely that 3- and 4-year-olds would have had much an idea about their political leanings. A few decades later, however, Blocks followed up with more surveys looking again at personality and this time at politics as well. The whiny kids tended to grow up conservative and turned into rigid young adults who hewed closely to traditional gender roles and were uncomfortable with ambiguity. The confident kids turned out liberal and were still hanging loose, turning into bright, nonconforming adults with wide interests. The girls were still outgoing, but the young men tended to turn a little introspective. Interesting. Block's reasoning? Insecure kids look for the reassurance provided by tradition and authority, and they find it in conservative politics. The more confident kids are eager to explore alternatives to the way things are and thus find liberal politics more congenial. They point out in the article in the Toronto Star that this runs contrary to the American stereotype of wimpy liberals and strong conservatives, but I would say it's absolutely consistent with you know, my take on that, and that I think of many people. It's sort of like homophobia, you know. It's like the big, tough, macho guys who are, hey, let's go out and kick a few queers, you know. They're the ones who are the most insecure about their own sexuality. They're the ones who deep down inside are terrified that they might be gay. And so they put on this big front about being tough, punch out a few, right? And so similarly, the so-called tough conservatives are being tough because they're terrified. They're the whiny, terrified little kids who have grown up, and they just don't know what to do with them. By the way, one of our listeners sent me an email pointing out yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, maybe the day before, I had said that back in May of 2003, this is from the Pew poll, the Pew Center poll, is a nonpartisan, very highly respected organization. Back in May of 2003, 52% of Americans described George W. Bush with positive words, words like good or Christian or honest, and that only 27% used negative words. Whereas now, in March of 2006, the most recent study, 28% of Americans, only 28% of Americans, use positive words like good, Christian, or honest, and 48% use negative words like incompetent, idiot, or liar. And one of our listeners pointed out to me, it wasn't that 48% of people used the words idiot, incompetent, or liar. It was that 48% used words like that. And in fact, here, out of 710 respondents, 29 used the word incompetent, 21 used the word idiot, 17 used the word liar, 13 used the word arrogant, 8 used the word ass, 7 used the word jerk, 7 used the word stupid, 6 used the word selfish, and 6 used the word untrustworthy. For example, these are one-word descriptions. These are not percentages. That's the actual raw numbers. So it wasn't that 48% used the words incompetent, idiot, or liar. It's just that those were the most frequently used words among the 48% who described George W. Bush using negative terms. And interestingly, the day that this study came out, we had this incredible photo op, Operation Swarmer. Everybody's all hysterical about, oh, never quite made the news cycle. As far as I know, the only national media that reported on this Pew study was Keith Olbermann. Countdown. Very interesting. Senator Pat Roberts, by the way, as they point out over at Think Progress, giving lapdogs a bad name. He recently said that he resents being called the lapdog of the administration. And, you know, Chicago Tribune columnist Steve Chapman says, you know, he agrees. That label is unfair because even lapdogs will bite if they're kicked often enough. But the Bush administration, they just keep kicking. And Pat Roberts, who, by the way, was on one of the national programs, I believe it was Face the Nation, 3 weeks ago or so, and he picked up a prescription bottle next to him, and he says, these here are memory pills. And to the best of my knowledge, there's only one drug out there, prescription drug for memory, and it's a drug being prescribed to people in the early stages of Alzheimer's, which is causing a lot of people to wonder what was Pat Roberts doing shaking that pill bottle. In any case, he has said repeatedly that he was going to, as head of the Judiciary Committee, that he was going to look into the possibility of illegal wiretaps in the United States. He said he's going to do it. Now he's not going to do it. Then more recently, Tim Russert said, you believe the Constitution gives the President of the United States the authority to do anything he believes is necessary to protect the country? Yes, says Roberts. But I wouldn't say anything he believes. What? This makes no sense. He blocked a vote on domestic wiretapping investigations. Jay Rockefeller's absolutely flipped out about this thing. He's got this proposal. Right, Roberts, let's just put it off. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. George W. Bush in Ohio.
Anybody work here in this town?
Anybody work here in this town? Here's the problem, boy George. When you became president, Cleveland had an unemployment rate of 4.5%. It's now 5.8%. Ohio had an unemployment rate of 4%. It's now 5.3%. Cleveland had a poverty rate of 24.3%. It's now 31.3%. Yeah, this is real funny.
Anybody work here in this town?
Real funny. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I understand that George W. had a press conference today. I've gotten a few clips and a few little pieces fed from it. Were you there?
I was there. Yeah, I was there waving my hand on your behalf, but he didn't come to me. He's afraid of the questions that you and I would ask, Tom.
I'm sure of it, but apparently he got in a little bit of a tiff with Helen Thomas and was shooting daggers at her from his eyeballs.
He was in a tiff with Helen. Well, look, he called on Helen Thomas. That in itself means that it's going to be a difficult question.
Well, and it means that he's desperate.
Well, apparently he feels very confident after yesterday in Cleveland. The feeling in the White House is that yesterday's Q&A went very well. Also, the White House press corps was kind of expecting a press conference this week, sort of, maybe, but they had put it down for Thursday because there are no scheduled events. So when we got this notification at like 8:40 telling us there would be a press conference at 10 and we had to call ourselves in by 8:50, right?
Do you think that maybe on some days George W. wakes up and they say, you know, he's having a pretty good day today. He doesn't need to take his medication. Let's call a press conference.
Well, I certainly think that there are days when he has a good day and he feels positive. What they had said, they sent out a schedule last night, and it said that the morning gaggle was at 9:45, the press briefing was at 12:30. Now, was that a lie to divert us, or at that time was it the truth and they hadn't decided?
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe they gave him his medication and then waited to see how it affected him.
Anything is possible. Now, he worked as he always does from a list,
mm-hmm.
Which is very frustrating to those of us who are not on the list.
Yeah.
Or who may be on the list with a black skull and crossbones through our name.
Like the folks from Talk Radio News.
Well, one never knows. But Helen, you see, was sitting in the middle of the front row, and there have been comments recently over his ignoring Helen Thomas. She,
sure.
She's been doing the job for 50 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, oh, she's so old, she doesn't know what she's doing. Well, she certainly knew what she was doing today when she asked him, why did he really go to war?
And tell us what happened.
He denied the premise of her question and said no president wants to go to war. You know, said he didn't want to go to war, and he wouldn't be there if he didn't think that we could succeed. Nobody likes war. It creates a sense of uncertainty in the country. War creates trauma. And then she interrupted him, and he interrupted her, then she interrupted him.
She was trying to set him straight, wasn't she? She was trying to point out to him that he talked about being a war president, that back in 99 he had told his biographer, Mickey Hertzkowitz, that he was going to go to war.
Well, she talked about the members of his administration, Rumsfeld and Cheney, for example, who had indicated earlier on, before he came to office, that they were interested in having some kind of a war.
Right, in 98, in fact, they signed the PNAC thing.
But he said that no, that he did not want to be at war. He was very, very clear on that.
Right.
Also, interestingly, apropos of nothing, at one point he called on somebody called Ken, and two people answered, because there were two people with names similar to Ken, and he looked down on his list to the one he was supposed to go to, and he said, no, I can't come to you, I have to do what I'm told.
By whom?
Exactly!
I can't.
You are
the President of the United States. That's the soundbite I want. The President of the United States saying, I have to do what I'm told.
I have to do what I'm told.
And it wasn't Laura who was telling him.
I don't think so.
Yeah, amazing.
But that's hopeful for someone like me who's thinking maybe it's Scott McClellan and maybe Scott would want a question by me to be asked.
Somehow I think Karl Rove has more of a hand in it than Scotty McClellan, but you never know.
Well, this is it. You never do know, and we never will know.
Yeah. So what else is news in Washington, D.C. today, Victoria Jones?
Well, there's one other thing that he said in terms of Iraq. He was asked a question by Cox about does he see a time when there will be no Americans' presence in Iraq? Now, and the guy said, I'm not looking for a timetable. And he said that would be a decision for future presidents and administrations.
Right. In other words, not in the next 3 years.
That was pretty much what we got from that, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, other than that, the only things going on are the Moussaoui trial, because Congress is not in session. The Moussaoui trial, where FBI agents continue to point out that they tried to tell people 70 times that Moussaoui wanted to fly a plane into a building and nobody would listen.
Right, yeah. The administration certainly had the information.
Right, Right. And so the government's case, which is that if Moussaoui had only spoken when he was being interrogated, they could have stopped 9/11, is really very precarious. And Judge Brinkema has indicated that all along, that she thinks this is a very, very weak case for getting the death penalty for somebody. But we don't know what the jury thinks at this point.
Interesting. Very interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. Hope you have a wonderful day there. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Speaking of reason, Russ Feingold displaying some. I just have to play this clip. He was on Charlie Rose. Then we'll be taking your calls, and we've got a whole stack of stuff here to go through today. But this is priceless. This is so well said. You heard in the last hour, I believe it was, or maybe the top of this hour, a little while ago, you heard the ad from the GOP about how Russ Feingold is trying to stop the president from tracking down the terrorists. And they're rolling this thing out. I mean, they're rolling it out big time. Here's Russ Feingold on Charlie Rose.
The president got out and said, basically, tough luck. I'm going to do whatever I want to do here, whether it's within the law or not. That, to me, demands a response. And I decided that we had to at least look at the possibility of letting the president know on the record that what he has done here is illegal and wrong. And that's why I propose censure. I did not propose impeachment because, to me, obviously, that's a more extreme step. And you have to consider whether this is really a good time to be talking about removing the president from office, even though this is conduct that I think the founding fathers would have found right within the strike zone of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Cowabunga. Yes. Yes, Russ Feingold. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont, listening on WVAA. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got to say, first little point is that study you read about, Republicans being whiners when they're kids.
Mm-hmm. Not Republicans, conservatives. There are some liberal Republicans out there.
Yeah, but it rings true, and I'm sure that pissed a lot of people off when that one came out.
In all probability, yeah. The researchers are probably taking some serious flack for that.
Yeah. I just want to ask you a question. It's not really a question, but could you explain why you give the libertarians so much voice out here?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than Republicans or that sort of thing. I mean, I think I understand the strategy, but could you explain to your audience maybe why you do it?
Well, there's
and,
really...
and also, because I think a lot of people don't understand even what a libertarian is. It sounds glorious.
Yeah, libertarians are Republicans who smoke pot.
Yeah, that.
I mean, that's the simple explanation. I actually was very entranced with libertarianism at one point.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, and then I saw the light. But there are two reasons why we put folks from Ayn Rand on, and the Ayn Rand pretty much about once a week, more or less.
Yeah, and I'm not criticizing it. I'm just curious of what your reasons were.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. The first reason is that they are the philosophical grandparents of the modern conservative movement,
uh-huh.
of the libertarian movement, and of the Grover Norquist, George W. Bush variety of conservatives.
Yep.
And I think it's important for Americans, for our listeners anyway, presumably a lot of them are Americans. I know we get calls from all over the world, and I certainly get email from all over the world. But for Americans in particular, to realize that strain of what calls itself conservatism doesn't really believe in democracy. It believes in an economic system which basically was the primary economic system for most of the world for most of the 7,000 years of what we call civilization, which is feudalism. It's a system, you know, where you have a feudal lords basically make the rules, run the thing. They own the land, they own the people, they own everything, and you have a small ruling class and you know the elite, as it were, and then you have a large class of serfs. You have a large, you know, working class that have no power, have no authority. And the nice thing, and I say that, and I mean this, you know, sincerely, the nice thing about the folks at Ayn Rand, Yaron Brook and the others, is that they're honest. They're intellectually honest. They'll come right out and say, I don't believe in democracy. And, I mean...
Could I ask you a question? I mean, like,
sure.
I'm a big fan of yours, and... what got you attracted to that doctrine? I mean, how old were you when you did that? I mean, what?
I was a teenager.
Okay.
You know, and just the idea of individual freedom. I mean, you know, we all, I can't say we all, but I certainly grew up with this whole, you know, Daniel Boone idea, you know, with a rugged individualist. We're Americans. We go our own way. This is the land of opportunity. Anybody can grow up to be rich, all that kind of stuff. And I've had a lot of opportunities in my life, and I've taken, you know, I've done a lot of, you know, things that were the result of my own hard work. I could pat myself on the back about. So it's, you know, and I've blown a few, but by and large, you know, so, you know, when I was first exposed to libertarian philosophy, I thought, yeah, it makes a certain amount of sense. You know, the whole John Stossel argument kind of thing. But the problem is you dig two layers deep and you have any understanding at all about the commons, and it starts to fall apart. The other reason, by the way, Jeff, I said there's two reasons why I put them on the air. That's one reason. The other reason is Republicans won't come on with me.
Right, no, I agree with
you. And this is a real struggle. We are constantly trying to get Republicans.
I think it's the way the Republicans are going. And, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I read Ayn Rand, too.
Yeah.
You know, I went more the communist way. I was reading Karl Marx, the Communist Manifesto, all these things.
Yeah, well, I read that in Das Kapital as well. And I think Marx's, by the way, I think his diagnosis of capitalism in Das Kapital was accurate. You know,
accurate.
It's just that his solution didn't work, you know.
Right. He was an idealist. He wasn't an economist. Yeah.
Which is the same thing with the objectivists.
So could I make one last comment? I know
sure.
I've been on a little bit, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, here's my idea. I'm like, you know, I know you're interested in early childhood education. And, you know something? If any parent, if I had a neighbor or whatever in my little community, that they were teaching values to their 4 or 5 year old kids, that the best things were selfishness, greed, getting what you want all the time. Pretty much. I mean, you'd be calling Child Protective Services.
Yeah, this is a stunted emotional development, Jeff. It really is, and it's a real tragedy. Frankly, when you look at Ayn Rand's story, I mean, she was 7, 8, 9 years old, something like that, pre-adolescent. She was a kid when the Bolshevik Revolution happened in Russia, and her father lost his pharmacy. He owned a drugstore, and she never got over that. I mean, you know, they came in, the government came in and took his business, and he was, you know, part of the kind of mercantile class. I mean, basically the only middle class that existed in Tsarist Russia,
yep.
And they lost their middle class lifestyle. They had a reduction in their lifestyle. She went on to university in Kiev, where she studied political science and learned that it's capitalism versus communism and the capitalism as a political system, which it's not. But that's what they taught there. And then she came to the United States and thought that capitalism was what was our political system. And it's not. Our political system is democracy and a constitutionally limited representative republic, you know.
Absolutely.
And she never got it. And tragically, the Norquists of the world and the whole rest of them, they never get it either. But I do think that it's important that people listening to the program understand the philosophical underpinning of these guys, and that's why I will continue to have them on, because every one of us has some place in our lives somebody who has bought into this stuff. And, you know, whether it's because they're Republicans or whether it's because they're libertarians or whatever. I mean, this last weekend I was in Michigan visiting my family, my parents and my three brothers. And, you know, my dad's got a picture of George Bush on the wall next to his picture of me shaking hands with the Pope. And, you know, what can I say? I mean, we all have Republicans in our families. We all have people that, you know, and so my goal is to help people learn how to win the water cooler wars. How can you have a conversation about this stuff? Really get down to the real issues, the real honest issues here, and not leave blood on the floor when you're done.
I agree with you, and I was not complaining that you have these guys on.
Yeah.
I thought there was something behind it a little bit.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, Jeff.
Thanks
a lot for the call. Good talking with you. Bill in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you. And thank you for all you do.
You're welcome. Please patronize our advertisers.
I sure will think about it. On my limited income, but at any rate, I would.
Well, even if you just call them up and say, "Hey, I heard you on the Tom Hartman program," that goes a long way for the radio stations or web stations or what Sirius, however you may be listening. You know, it goes a long way.
At least to respond to them.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. This is listener supported radio. That
I didn't get a chance to hear Bush's speech until last night on the replay on C-SPAN in Cleveland here, because I was with a bunch of people outside the hotel where he was speaking.
You were in a free speech zone?
No, actually, it was directly across. It was close to where he was at. It was directly across the street from the hotel where he was speaking, the Renaissance. And by the way, for the people that think demonstrations don't work anymore, that's misinformation. Yeah, you need to let them know that we're still here.
Oh yeah.
But I gotta say, after watching the replay of the speech last night and watching his press conference this morning, the guy is losing it, man.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that because I'm anti-Bush. It's just the guy is feeling the pressure, and it really shows. But the most important thing about his speech yesterday was who was not there. The governor of Ohio was not there, Bob Taft.
Right.
Of course, he's not doing well these days anyway.
Right. Neither was Ken Blackwell, was he?
Pardon me, sir?
Ken Blackwell is running for governor. He was not there either, was he?
I don't think any of the Republicans that were running for governor were there.
Yeah.
But also DeWine and Voinovich are the two senators from Ohio, were not there either. So, you know, just look at the people that are distancing themselves from the president. And, you know.
Well, I've been saying all along, Bill, that Bush and Rove are suggesting to Republicans in the House and Senate that they run against George W. Bush because they've got to get these Republicans reelected. Otherwise, Bush is facing impeachment and Rove is facing prison.
Well, they're going to have a heck of a time doing it.
Yeah, I agree with you, but they're going to keep at it. Thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you in the No Boring Zone. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS, where you can get the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, and PC stuff as well. Cool stuff there. It's 9 minutes before the hour, number 1-866-440-8466. Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I got into a conversation on Sunday night with my sister, and I told her, you know, I'm 47 years old, and I wanted my first Peace March. We got to Peace March, and we got on a conversation about the war because she's very conservative, and we got in a big argument about the, you know, whether we should be in Iraq or not, and then we started talking about Bush and got in a big argument about that, and then she was telling me about the Patriot Act and how it was, you know, it was finally Bush was doing something, and, you know, and she explained to me her part, something that she had to do for her bank. She runs a small credit union, and she has to go through everybody's financial records, apparently, and I don't know whether the government gives her a criteria of what to look for or whether they're taking part, but how she has to spend so much time going through everybody's financial records, and she said they'd found two suspected terrorists in, you know, that work, you know, or have accounts in their bank. And it just amazed me that she's telling me about the government is telling her that they got to go through everybody's financial records and look for certain things. I don't know whether the government is taking part in that, or they had let that, you know, give them some criteria, and then you go through the records, and then, you know, here's the red flags to look for and let us know.
And she's telling me about how, well, you know, two people are suspected terrorists through her branch. And, you know, imagine how many more there are out there. Well, you know, if it's just in
how many bank branches are there in Grand Rapids? There must be 200-300.
Yeah.
So that if two terrorists apiece, that's 600-800 terrorists. That's a lot.
But I mean, you know, it's
a, you're in a hotbed of.
What's the criteria? Are they sending money home to Iraq? You know, mom and dad don't have jobs anymore because, you know, dad's not working in the refinery anymore because Halliburton's working there.
Well,
so
we've
I
done
don't know what the criteria is.
Right. Yeah, we've done two stories in the last week, Ken, about people who paid off their credit card balances and had their payments frozen by the Department of Homeland Security. And in one case, it was over $5,000. It was a little over $6,000, actually. And I knew that, you know, for years, this goes back to the so-called war on drugs, that any cash transaction over $5,000 is supposed to be reported to the IRS. But apparently, so I figured this was the $5,000 rule. But then Wednesday, Thursday, last week, we got a story of a woman who simply paid $650 off on a credit card balance. And the Department of Homeland Security slammed her with it and locked up her account. And there's something going on here, something really weird. And then also the administration now refusing to say whether they are or they are not breaking into our homes without warrants.
Right. And that's what bothers me. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know what, we've got these people that we're looking at, and we found out that they're banking in, you know, with you, and let us know if there's any, you know, strange transactions, if they're dealing with somebody that, you know, might be on our list as, you know, financing or funneling money to terrorists and stuff like that. But no, go through everybody. They want everybody's records. They want you to go through every person and their financial records, and then we'll look for terrorists in that, you know.
Yeah.
And it bothered me a lot.
Not good. Not good. Yeah, it bothers me too. Ken, thanks a lot for the heads up. Renee in Murfreesboro, Illinois, WINI. Hey, Renee.
Howdy, Tom. You're one of my heroes, dude.
Well, thank you, Renee.
And I would frequent the local ads, but they're doing Roundup Ready ads right now, and I can't go there.
Well, you know, what can you say?
So we got primaries going on here in Illinois today.
Yeah.
They had a local channel, news channel, talking about the new machines that were coming in.
Uh-oh.
When I called today to find out where they'd moved my voting site this year, I found out that it is the infamous Diebold machines. And even more disturbing than that to me is the fact that our local TV media, when I called there to ask why they didn't delve into it a little more, had no clue why this could even be an issue.
You're kidding.
No. The guy said, I've been a reporter for 20 years, dude. You know, and I'm going, well, I'm sorry, but I think this is kind of somebody's slacking off here if you don't understand the
issue. Yeah, has this guy been living under a rock for 20 years?
I don't know. We are in the very extreme part, southern part of the state, but there is a university here.
Well, and I've been on the air there for a couple of years.
Thank you for the voice of reason. So, I don't know. You know, I heard you say earlier you fool the people some of the times, you know, that, well, I'm afraid there's a lot of people. Even when I called the voter's office, the county clerk or whatever it was, nobody there even had a clue what Diebold machines were. It was just like, whoa.
That's scary.
Whoa.
Well, Renee, thanks for speaking out and keep on, you know, I'm assuming that you're informing these folks.
I'm doing my best.
Okay, keep at it. Renee, thanks a lot for calling the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to hear from you. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick, we have just a little less than a minute left. What's up?
You're my hero, Tom.
Well, thank you, Dick.
You know, I support America. I just want to build.
If you are spreading the word along, you are my hero, too.
Yes, and I just wanted to tell you, if he comes to Ohio, see, that's where my family's from, up north there, create the jobs, get the economy, please don't
cut
the Medicare.
Yeah, the way you
don't
do that is...
Medicare.
Yeah, the way you do that is you stop offshoring our jobs, and Bush says it's a good thing to offshore jobs.
Right.
You stop outsourcing our jobs. He says it's a good thing. You stop selling off our country to foreign companies and you know, he says that's a good thing. In fact, he's going to veto any legislation to try and stop. I mean, this guy is so out of touch with reality. He lives in the world, the bubble world of millionaires and billionaires, and that's it.
That's it. Well, I'm going to keep writing my legislatures, and I'm going to send you some good stuff in the mail.
Great. Thanks a lot,
Bye-bye.
Dick. Good talking to you, and thanks for listening. It's just incredible what's going on here with the Bush administration and how many people are truly waking up to it, and whether or not George is going to be able to hold this thing together. You look at yesterday's press conference, this morning's press conference, and you wonder, can he do three more years of this? Or, you know, is he on Prozac or something? I mean, it's like it's you get these weird changes in affect from day to day. It's just, I don't know. I'm scratching my head increasingly, and I don't mean that in any kind of sarcastic or you know, trying to take a cheap shot way. I really am concerned about our country. 57 minutes past the hour.
To the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, on cable TV systems in 29 states. And on AirAmericaRadio.com. Judy Wicks is the owner and founder of Philadelphia's 23-year-old White Dog Cafe, a national leader in the local living economies movement. This is our Bioneers segment for the week, founded in 1990. Bioneers, a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org, their website, whitedog.com, Judy Wicks' website. Judy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. Judy, you're listed as one of America's 25 most generous companies. Now, the conservative guests who come on this program tell me that the reason that you go into business is not to be generous or to help your community. It's to get rich. What's wrong with you, Judy?
Guess I'm just a wacko. No, you know what? Our mission, I believe that the purpose of business is to serve. And so our mission is to serve and four areas, serving our customers, our staff, our community, and our natural world. And,
well, it's okay to make a living, too, isn't it?
And it's okay to make a living, too, yeah.
And even a very good living?
I'd make a decent living, yep.
And in fact, your business is generating about $5 million a year
in
turnover, and they have about 100 employees through White Dog Enterprises. Marvelous what you're doing. Tell us, you know, how did you get started with this?
Well, I started as a waitress, and I began the White Dog in the first floor of my house as a coffee and muffin takeout shop 23 mm-hmm. years ago. And my first turnout kitchen was a charcoal grill in the backyard. So I started very humbly and just built it over time, just adding more and more and until what we are today. And I've really used my business as a place to gather people to discuss the issues of the day. And I kind of joke that I'm not really in the restaurant business. What I really do is I use good food to lure innocent customers into social activism.
In Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, you're also, this is just a wonderful story, and it's also a story of what can be done by people who really care about what they're doing. First of all, you're obviously serving good food. In fact, you even co-authored a cookbook about this.
That's right. Yeah, we have excellent food. We buy from local farmers. All of our meat and poultry are from small-scale farmers where the animals are raised on pasture, humanely treated. And we've also get all of our fish from sustainable fisheries, sustainable sources. And
but at the same time, you've been sponsoring trips to Mexico, Cuba, Nicaragua, the Netherlands, Lithuania?
Yeah. We have an international sister restaurant project called Table for 6 Billion, Please, that envisions everyone having a place at the table politically and economically. And we take groups of our customers and staff to countries where we would like to change U.S. foreign policy, basically.
Yeah.
And right now, our next trip is actually to New Orleans. We're taking 35 people to New Orleans to do community service work, 10 employees and 25 customers.
Oh, and there's a need for
April.
It there. There's a real need for it there.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, you're also working with inner-city high school kids.
Yeah, we have a mentoring program we've had for about 13 years where we work with 6 kids a year that are interested in going into the restaurant business. And they work in the kitchen, the dining room, the office, and we take them on field trips and so on.
We're talking with Judy Wicks. WhiteDog.com is the website. Philadelphia's 23-year-old White Dog Cafe. You also have a black cat operation there.
That's our gift store.
Right. How did that come about?
Well, I was in the retail business before I was in the restaurant business. My first business was a little store called the Free People Store that became Urban Outfitters, if you can believe that, a national chain that my ex-husband owns. But anyway, so after I got the White Dog started, I decided I wanted to start a retail store next door, and I thought, well, White Dog, Black Cat. It's kind of cute.
There
you
go.
So that's
now, the
came about.
The core model of everything that you're doing boils down to local living economies and the concept of, well, I guess local living economy, that an economy is actually a living thing and that it has a local basis. Make
that's
that
right.
real for us. What does that mean?
What does what mean?
What does that mean?
That a local living economy?
Right.
Yeah. Well, the idea here is that, you know, you keep hearing about how can we create a sustainable global economy, but the way I see it, that we can't have a socially, environmentally, financially sustainable global economy without having sustainable local economies. And so we see the global economy is a network of sustainable local economies, or what we call living economies, so that rather than having this global economy that's is controlled by these large multinational corporations, we see this intricate network of small to small around the globe. And we call it a living economy because it supports both natural life and community life. And the idea is to bring economic power back from these distant boardrooms to our local communities through local business ownership.
And yet the multinationals have to be, you have to be experiencing the pressure of this. I mean, there's all these, I mean, just even the franchise companies. I mean, you can drop into any city in America, and it's indistinguishable from any other city in America these days, very different than just 30 years ago, because local economies are pretty much dead.
Well, we're having a resurgence, and that is one of the issues that, you know, that every city looks the same with these chain stores and whatnot, and that's one of the advantages of having local ownership is that your city or town has identity, has a local a character to it that distinguishes it. So that's another advantage of local ownership besides the economic, the direct economic advantage of creating community wealth. Because, you know, when you have a locally owned business, if you shop in a business that's a chain, say you spend $100 in a chain versus spending $100 in a locally owned store, of that $100, when you shop locally, $45 stays in the local economy, because that business hires locally, has a local accountant or website creator or whatever. And if you spend that $100 in a chain store, only $14 stays. So it's $14 versus $45. So when we shop in chain stores, it's just sucking capital right out of our communities and taking it, to faraway boardrooms and stockholders and other parts
right.
of the world.
Every night all around the world, a button gets pushed and billions of dollars go like that to McDonald's headquarters in Chicago and to Bentonville, Arkansas, Walmart's headquarters, and it just right out of all these local economies.
Right, exactly.
And, in fact, with a local economy, not only does the money get recycled through the use of local merchants, but if you're using a local bank, if you can find one,
mm-hmm.
then that money gets relent out to other people who may want to start other businesses.
Right, and that's another really important part of our movement, that we're suggesting that rather than investing in the stock market, which again takes capital out of our communities, we put our money, into a local financial institution. If it's not a bank, it could be, in my case, in Philadelphia, we have something called the Reinvestment Fund,
mm-hmm.
and I have 100% of my savings in the Reinvestment Fund, and for which I get a 5% return. It's like a promissory note. And then that money is relent in my community. And we call that a type of investing getting a living return. So my return is not just a financial one on a 5% interest, but it's the advantage of living in a more prosperous local community because that capital is going to work for my neighborhood, my community. And just as an example of that, the Reinvestment Fund funded the wind turbines that I now get my electricity from for the White Dog. So, and that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't put I and others didn't put our money into the Reinvestment Fund instead of in the stock market. So that's actually going to work to help our community be more energy self-reliant.
Well, and in fact, Judy Wicks, livingeconomies.org, by the way, another website that you're involved with, you co-founded, is it pronounced Bally?
Yeah, Bally.
BALLE, an international alliance of 25 independently operated local business networks, more than 4,500 members working on this sort of thing. And you're doing this not just in the United States. Do you do microcredit loans?
No, we don't. We don't do any loaning. But again, we encourage people to invest in local financial institutions that will do local loans, small loans, and so on. But we're in Canada as well as the United States. We've got networks in Toronto, Vancouver, and Victoria right now, and an emerging one in Montreal. Most of our networks are in the United States. And we're having our big international conference, our fourth annual, coming up in June in Burlington this year.
Burlington, Vermont?
Yep, June
8th
to the 10th.
And we're on the air right now on WVAA.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
People in Burlington, Vermont are listening.
Independent media is part of this movement because, you know, this is all about really about decentralization of everything, decentralization of our food system, decentralization of energy sources, decentralization of ownership, decentralization of media, to have many forms of media so we don't just rely on, you know, a mass media for our information, but rather from many different smaller sources.
That's
a really important part of this.
And I think increasingly we're going to, and speaking as national talent, increasingly we're seeing local programming growing, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a healthy thing for
Absolutely.
America. Judy Wicks, livingeconomies.org, whitedog.com. Judy, thanks so much for being with
You're
us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Great
thanks
talking. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Radio operator, do you ever think of me? 'Cause I'm a gleam on some horizon.
Yeah, this is a Dan Jacobs song here. Welcome back, my friends. The Guardian, February 3rd of this year. The Guardian, the newspaper out of the U.K., quote, the memo of a two-hour meeting between Bush and Blair at the White House on January 31st, 2003, nearly 2 months before the invasion, reveals that Mr. Bush made it clear the U.S. intended to invade whether or not there was a second U.N. resolution, and even if U.N. inspectors found no evidence of a banned Iraqi weapons program. The Downing Street minutes from July 23rd, 2002, quoting British intelligence, quote, it seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. Richard Clark, on the program 60 Minutes, former White House counterterrorism director, quote, Rumsfeld was saying that we needed to bomb Iraq, and we all said, no, no, Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. Now, this is right after 9/11. And we all said, no, no, Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. The president dragged me into a room with a couple other people, shut the door, and said, I want you to find out whether Iraq did this. Now, he never said make it up, but the entire conversation left me in absolutely no doubt that George Bush wanted me to come back with a report that said that Iraq did this. End of quote. Rumsfeld's notes on 9/11/01. Quote, find the best info fast, judge whether good enough to hit Saddam Hussein at the same time, not only Osama bin Laden. Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of the Treasury, on 60 Minutes, quote, from the very beginning, he's talking about the beginning of the Bush administration, from the very beginning there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and that he needed to go. It was all about finding a way to do it. That was the tone of it. The president was saying, go find me a way to do this. 14 months before the Gulf War started, 14 months before the Gulf War started, Foreign Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Bob Graham had a conversation with Tommy Franks. In February of 2002, Franks said, quote, Senator, we are not engaged in a war in Afghanistan. Military and intelligence personnel are being redeployed to prepare for an action in Iraq. We can finish this job in Afghanistan if we're allowed to do so. So it's pretty clear that when George said...
You say we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
That he was just plain old lying through his teeth, and he did it again today with Helen Thomas.
To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, and all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true.
Just not true. Just not true. No president wants war. Don't you get it, Helen? Yet, your Secretary of the Treasury says that you wanted war. General Tommy Franks said that you wanted war. I mean, it's at what point are we supposed to say, oh, you know, it's, and I mean, your brother, Jeb, in 1998 asked for the war, signing the PNAC, the Project for a New American Century document. Don Rumsfeld signed it. Dick Cheney signed it 2 years before you came into office. And then, of course, there's what your, you know, when your family hired Nikki Herskowitz, a writer and a 20-year family friend of the Bush family, to write your, to ghostwrite your autobiography, A Charge to Keep, as Cindy Sheehan pointed out before John Conyers' commission.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed. You get it?
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I mean, this is increasingly so transparent, and yet Bush is still lying through his teeth. I mean, just clearly he's defying what his vice president said, what Tommy Franks said, what Paul O'Neill said, what Richard Clark said, what Dick Cheney was doing.
To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, and all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true.
Yeah. And, of course, then there's also...
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And thus began Operation Iraqi Liberation. And, you know, you'll recall when the president's press secretary came out and said, we're beginning Operation Iraqi Liberation. And then about an hour later came out and said, we've changed the name. It's no longer Operation Iraqi Liberation. It's now Operation Iraqi Freedom. Well, you do the acronym yourself. O for Operation, I for Iraqi. Liberation, what's that letter there? 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a really interesting news today about George Bush's press conference. When he wasn't blaming the media, he was confronting them. Perhaps the most heated exchange today took place between Bush and Helen Thomas. When she found his answers to her questions about why we went to war unsatisfactory, Bush rudely glared at Thomas, repeatedly asking if he could finish. Thomas apparently had broken an unwritten White House rule under which no reporters are allowed to question the president when his lies set off their BS detectors. No moment better served as a metaphor of the Bush presidency than that callous dismissal of dissent. That's brilliant. It's from tpmcafe.com. Blog. Well said. Well done. Very well done, in fact. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jack in Everett, Washington on the line. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, what I'm calling about is the lady that called from Illinois about the voting machines.
Right.
My take on this is if we all voted absentee, then we'd circumvent the machines. They'd have to count the ballots by hand or by scanner.
Yeah.
And that would buy us some time until they get this garbage straightened out.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of if-only-everybody things, though, Jack. You know, it's the reality everybody is that everybody isn't going to do it, number one. And number two, you know, there's still almost 100,000 votes or slightly over 100,000 votes in Ohio, absentee votes, that have not been counted.
Yeah, well, if we don't do anything, they're going to steamroll us with it again.
Well, this is why I think that what we need to do is be getting politically active and getting organized at the local level and getting out there and hopefully, you know, encouraging the news organizations. Hopefully we can get some decent exit polls and just get enough of us out there in large enough quantities that there are some just absolutely such overwhelming wins that even with a rigged election machine or even with Ken Blackwell kind of games where they throw, you know, Ken Blackwell now, we know over 305,000 people he took off the voting rolls in principally Democratic areas in the months leading up to the 2004 election in Ohio. Even in the face of, and down in Florida, of course, you know, 25,000 people in just Miami-Dade County, in African-American communities taken off the voting rolls for no good reason, except that a felon with a similar name lived in Texas. You know, these kind of things just can't happen if enough of us are aware. I mean, we've had, in my opinion, 3 stolen elections, and it's time for us to be speaking up and standing up and speaking out. But I don't think that, frankly, I don't think that voting absentee is the solution.
Okay, well, I think the solution, right on with the rest of it.
Yeah, the solution over the short term, Jack, is to contact your Secretary of State's office and to contact your county election official's office and say, I don't want to vote on electronic machines. I don't want a private corporation handling my vote at any point. I want my vote to be handled by people who are answerable to me, you know, we the people. And I want it to be done. If it's being done on a computer, I want it open source software. I don't want a private corporation handling my vote. Please assure me that that's going to be the case. And if the secretaries of state of the various states and if the county election officials get enough phone calls from people like you and me saying things like that, then there will be change.
Yeah, well, we've already addressed that problem here in Washington State. And in Snohomish County, where I live, is doing away with polls and going strictly to absentee.
Yeah, they're going to vote by mail like we have in Oregon, and that's
correct.
Largely as the result of Paul. What's Paul's last name? The lawyer down there in Snohomish County who brought the lawsuit.
I know who you're talking about.
Yep, brilliant guy, doing great work. Well, Jack, thanks a lot for the call.
You bet. Keep up.
Good to hear from you. Thank you. You too, Michelle in Antioch, California. Hey, Michelle, what's on your mind today? Michelle. She's up. Well, she must be listening to her radio instead of her phone. We'll come back to her in a minute. Sheila in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Sheila.
You were having a conversation yesterday with Victoria Jones, and she mentioned that Bush is very, very worried and concerned about an attack of bird flu. Well, I checked, and last October, he made a speech in which he said after Katrina that he would install the military in any future disasters, especially a bird flu disaster. To me, this says martial law. What does it mean for business? What does it mean for our bank accounts?
Wow, just in time for the 2006 or 2008 elections.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly.
Oh, my. Well, yeah. Sheila, you just had to bring a little reality into our day. And
sorry.
That's interesting. If you have a link to that speech, or if you
I
do, you know, do you have the date? Do you just know all actually?
It was October 6th, and this was an article on CNN, and it says Bush military bird flu role slammed. It was from Thursday, October 6th, 2005.
Great, we can track that down. David's writing it down right now.
Yes.
That's interesting revelation. Sheila, thank you very much for that.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tom.
I appreciate
Thank
it. Here,
you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye now. Cheryl in Arcata, California. Hey, Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Sure.
Yeah, but my thought of the day and sort of my my beef is more lies. Yesterday, the story that came out on Saddam's foreign minister spying for the CIA is just more fuel to impeach this guy. It turns out that Naji Sabri, who's a foreign minister under Saddam Hussein, spied for the CIA before the U.S.-led invasion in 2003 in exchange for $100,000.
Right, and told us that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Right, and he said he wanted a nuclear bomb, but needed much more time to build one, And he also denied that Saddam had any biological weapons. And Sabri's tips were actually thought to be more accurate than the CIA's own guesses that Saddam had an arsenal. And, you know, and we let this guy go because, here comes the joke, he was a jack of all trades. And he wasn't part of the deck of cards, you know, the most wanted.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just, it goes along with the Downing Street memo, and it just shows that this president did want a war, and it's all just nonsense to say that he didn't, and he's just done nothing but lie to Americans. And all I can say is people, as you mentioned, have to get out there, contact their local Democratic Central Committee, and volunteer, and just get everybody to go out and vote, because people can see how bad it is out there. I mean, it's a cesspool of problems. And yesterday it was like a sign from God, like, stop the insanity. We had a cyclone. It hit at 180 miles per hour.
Right.
I mean, storms are getting increasingly just enormous.
Well, the last time, I got to tell you, Cheryl, that was in Australia, just north of Perth. We have some good friends who live in Perth. In fact, the last time I was in Australia was about 4 years ago. It was just about just before we started this program. And they were having all these fires in Sydney, down in New South Wales. And we were staying with some friends in Sydney. And we were watching the evening news. And this was ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the national newscast. And the weather forecaster, the weather person comes on, the weather guy, and he's talking about, you know, the weather and where the fires are. And he says, and we can expect as a result of global warming that this part of Australia is going to experience more drought, and there's probably going to be more fires over here. And he's like standing in front of a map of the country, and he's like pointing out, and over here we probably get a little extra rain, and, you know, and he's talking about how the climate's going to change in what parts of the country, and just as a very matter-of-fact thing. And this is like 4 years ago. Come back to the United States, and we're still arguing about whether there's even climate change happening.
Yeah, well, yesterday they were actually talking on the news, and I was kind of sitting there with my jaw open going, my gosh, they're mentioning global warming on NBC News.
Yeah.
But I've kind of called it global weirding because, I mean, it's definitely, you've seen it. We had right before winter snow down to sea level.
Yeah.
and intensely bigger storms hitting us, lots of gusts of winds and instability. So, I mean, we have to vote Democratic to save the planet. That's all there is to it, and everybody has to get together.
Well said. Well said, Cheryl. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call. Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me again. You talk about 9/11 on occasion. You bring up the alternative theories. And I'm just wondering, I've read just about everything there is to read on that, and I have a real hard time coming up and answering half of the anomalies. You know, you can come up with some answers to some of them, but have you read a lot of the stuff? Have you read David Ray Griffin's books and so forth?
Yes, I've read two of his books, and I've had him as a guest on this program probably four times.
Shoot, I missed it.
I mean, it's been over a three-year period. You know,
the anomalies are just very, very difficult to answer. I mean, one of them that you brought up the other day was Bush seeing a plane that didn't crash.
Yeah, see, I don't consider that an anomaly. I consider that Bush being either a casual, comfortable liar or a pathological liar.
Yeah,
but I don't disagree. I'm not disagreeing with you, Michael, that there is a lot of unanswered questions. I think that 9/11 is going to go down for this generation, for people who are, you know, particularly for people who are young when 9/11 happened. It's going to be like the Kennedy assassination. And it's going to be just like the Kennedy assassination. It's going to be 40 years before anybody finally gets to the bottom of it.
Right. But I just, a lot of the anomalies, well, you don't consider that an anomaly, but a lot of, I have mostly progressive friends, and even they say, you know, when you come up with each anomaly at a time, they'll say, like you just said, you characterize it as something else, but when you have so many of them together, like Building 7, I know you've talked about that on your show,
yeah.
I've heard that, and just there's so many, and I wish this would not be marginalized. I'm not saying you're marginalizing it, at least you give it some airtime. But I think it's very
I think what we've come to, Michael, and it was very much like this around the Kennedy assassination in the 70s, too. It was just, you know, it was such a horrible thing. People just wanted to get, you know, back away from it for a little while. So it'll come back around. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Seems again of late, in a land divided by hate. Some pick up a sign, some a gun, in answer to the call. Headed off to war, what for? No one is really sure. Seems like no one sees the writing on the wall.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. No way, buddy. George W. Bush in Ohio yesterday.
Thank you for coming to Cleveland, Mr. President, and to the City Club. My question is that author and former Nixon administration official Kevin Phillips, in his latest book, American Theocracy, discusses what has been called radical Christianity and its growing involvement into government and politics. He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this? That the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism are signs of the apocalypse, and if not, why not?
The answer is, I haven't really thought of it that way. Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella.
Makes you long for the days of an articulate president like Richard Nixon. Dave in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
I had a question about the debt, the national debt.
Mm-hmm.
It's going up by nearly $3 trillion under Bush.
Right.
And only $250 billion is accounted for by the Iraq War. There have to be other expenses that have been, you know, kind of unexpected. There's been the Afghanistan War, Homeland Security Department, other things, but there seems to be like a lot of missing money. And how much is the tax cuts? How much do they account of this $3 trillion?
The last audit that I saw, the last, you know, kind of summary of how this all happened, which would, I believe was from the Center for Policy Studies. I could be wrong on the source of it, but it came down the road just maybe a week or so ago, indicated that had Bush's tax cuts never happened, that we would not have been, we would not have added to the debt. That our debt would still be $3 trillion lower than it was. And that Clinton was actually running a surplus. And that there was a surplus when Bush first came into office. And in fact, everybody was talking about, hey, we got the surplus, what are we going to do? You know, eventually we'll have, yeah, they were talking about over a 15-year period that we were going to pay the debt down to zero. And then there was all this discussion about that might be a bad thing because you have to have, you know, people want to be able to invest in U.S. government securities. You have to have some debt. And, I think that most economists would suggest that somewhere between half and three quarters of the increased debt, which shows up in the accumulation of 5 years of deficits, is the consequence of Bush's tax cuts.
Amazing. Half to three quarters.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. It depends. You know, there's different people who will give you different numbers. Bernanke, the new head of the Fed, didn't come out with a specific number, but he came last week. He was in the Wall Street Journal. He was quoted in the Wall Street Journal we talked about on this program, saying that this was a consequence of the tax cuts, and it was absolutely unsustainable.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. And this is the guy who, by the way, was the head of Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. I mean, when he was there, when he didn't have a job that, you know, was going to outlast the Bush administration, he was telling Bush what he wanted to hear. Now he's saying, oh, you know, maybe we should raise taxes. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, you're splicing together those audio clips and quotes of Bush administration officials highlighting Bush's lies leading up to the war. It was just brilliant, and it really, really chilling, too. And, you know, that points for me towards another widespread GOP lie that, that Democrats voted for the war.
Right. In fact, the two-thirds of the Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against giving Bush the authority to use force, and an overall majority of Democrats in the House and Senate, you know, in Congress combined, voted against it.
And that was, anyway, that, that resolution was just supposed to be a bargaining chip for Bush. It was, not going to go to war, only as a last resort.
But even at that, the Democrats voted against it, a majority of Democrats.
Absolutely. And I, you know, in my state of Washington, Senator Patty Murray, is just is flat, decent, and uncalculating, and honest, and would, you know, do the right thing every step of the way, and voted against that resolution. Rhea Cantwell, I think, was maybe giving Bush the benefit of the doubt and voted for that resolution. I find it incredible now that, that some Democratic activists here are taking that lie and swallowing it and turning it back against Rhea Cantwell. Say that she, in fact, you know, supports the war, and I just really find that disheartening. She's in a struggle to hold office in the upcoming election, and I think is making compromises with conservatives on the east side of the state.
Well, it's, and that's the reality of politics in every state. I mean, you know, in Washington State in particular, I was not pleased, frankly, to, you know, when Maria Cantwell voted against Alito, but didn't vote to stop cloture. In other words, you know, but you know, what can you say? I mean, I don't think that she is a sellout politician. There are some out there. There clearly are some Democrats who are sellouts, who are supporting the bankruptcy bill and are supporting CAFTA, and basically, you know, in the back pockets of corporations, and or who have a philosophy that should cause them to be Republicans, like Joe Lieberman. And I think I agree with you. I think Patty Murray is a great senator. I think Maria Cantwell is a decent senator. And certainly I'd work to reelect her. I mean, we need all the Democrats we can get. Bill, thanks a lot for the call and for raising the point. It's a good one. Well said. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Jeffrey Feldman from the Frame Shop is going to be here. New frame, the bank manager, and the basketball coach. Should the Democrats keep quiet or pump up the team? Larry Scott's going to be here with VA Watchdog, the new VA healthcare budget, 10% short of what the actual need is. Veterans are gearing for the battle. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.